Hassan Nasrallah, one of the most powerful figures in the region. We're joined by Gideon Levy. He is Israeli journalist, author, columnist for Haaretz, as well as a member of its editorial board. His latest piece, Israel's Barbaric Glee Over Nasrallah's Assassination, is a new low for Israeli society. Gideon, thanks so much for joining us again. If you can start off by talking about what happened on Friday. You have Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, ascending the podium at the UN General Assembly, apparently right after he gave the go-ahead for the assassination of Nasrallah, right before he came up on the podium. Dozens of world leaders walked out. If you can talk about the significance of this decision and then the bombing of Yemen and, of course, the continuation of the assault on Gaza.
You know, Amy, listening to your program is enough. Israel is shooting here, and Israel is assassinating there, and Israel is bombing here, and Israel is bombing there. Where are we aiming to? I mean, all those operations might be, at least part of them, are justified. But what comes next? This thought that Israel can solve everything by force, and the war is always the first answer for everything, must change, because otherwise we will really find ourselves one day totally lonely in the world. Even the United States, which supports Israel still blindly and automatically, they must emphasize in your show that the United States is a full partner for everything that Israel is doing in the last year, including the massacre in Gaza. Even the United States will wake up one day, and then what?
So talk about the assassination of Nasrallah. You're talking to us from Tel Aviv and the response in Israel.
I'll give you a few examples. In the one of the main channels of Israeli TV, a reporter, Life, was distributing chocolates. That's the spirit in Israel. That's the spirit. Another important columnist wrote, "We smashed him like a lizard." I mean, if this is the atmosphere, this is the mindset, this is the zeitgeist, even, so it will be very hard to change things, because we are getting down and down, lower and lower, believing more and more only in one thing, namely in killing and destructing.
So, if you can talk about what Netanyahu's strategy is, and if he has one other than a military strategy. You have the tanks, Israeli tanks, amassing on the border. Do you see a ground invasion of Lebanon happening at this point? What does this mean? Does he just want to deplete Hezbollah or completely wipe it out?
I can't see a scenario in which Israel is not going for a ground operation. First, it will be, as usual, presented as a very, very limited one, limited in time, limited in territory. We have been in those shows many times. And then it will get complicated, and then we'll have to widen it and expand the time that we stay there. As usual, we are getting into those things without having any clue, any idea how will we get out of it. Look at Israel in Gaza. Nobody has a clue how we are getting out of Gaza. We're not getting out of Gaza. Israel is going to repeat the same mistake with Lebanon, using the excuse or the passiveness of the world, which allows Israel to do now whatever it wants. Netanyahu, I think, is also now in euphoria after what is perceived in Israel as wonderful successes, James Bond successes, first with the pagers and with the walkie-talkies, and then with all the assassinations. This is perceived in Israel as an enormous success. So riding on this success, I guess nothing will stop Israel to get into a ground operation. And then, you know, there will be a moment that a regional war might become a factor, might become a reality. And then what, when Iran might come in? I mean, all those risks seem what? Unimportant, unreal. And if Iran comes into the picture, what's next? We will bomb Iran. This whole mindset of bombing and bombing for 1 year now, and only bombing and refusing any kind of diplomacy. Remember, there were deals to release the hostages. Israel said no. Ceasefire, Israel said no. Lebanon ceasefire, Israel says no. This will not guarantee the security of Israel, not to speak about the price the other side is paying, but even the security of Israel will not get better. We are now in a less good situation than 1 year ago. I can tell you that in Tel Aviv, we are more scared than we were 1 year ago.
The U.S. military said Sunday it's increasing its air support capabilities in the Middle East, putting troops on heightened alert. ABC News's Martha Raddatz interviewed White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby on this week Sunday and asked about the reports.
There's a contingency of additional forces in the region right now to help us with any possible contingencies that might come up.
Dozens more? I mean, I know we have 40,000 troops in the region.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the exact numbers or who these guys are, but we did deploy some additional forces into the region. I would tell you that there's other options available as well in terms of adding and enhancing that force posture.
So you talk, Gideon Levy, about a regional war. Right before Netanyahu spoke at the UN, as you said, there was this discussion that the U.S. and France was leading with Saudi Arabia and others and to have a ceasefire. And then Hassan Nasrallah is assassinated. Is this more than Israel engaging in a regional war, but trying to bring the U.S. into it as well? Netanyahu is known as a close Trump ally and friend, how that would affect the U.S. elections as well. And right before Netanyahu spoke at the United Nations, you have Israel saying Thursday it had secured another $8.7 billion in aid from the United States to support its ongoing military efforts. We're going to end with this question of whether Israel could continue what it does if the U.S. stopped the weapons flow.
But the U.S. does not stop the weapons. That's the point. The U.S. is saying one thing and acting exactly to the opposite direction. Can you believe that a major superpower is telling Israel to stop the war, and in the same time it is supplying it with weapons and bombs and ammunition? What is Israel supposed to do? Why not to shoot and to bomb, to continue to do this, if the Americans are supplying it in an unconditioned way? No conditions. So this hypocrisy must come to its end. The United States is supporting the war, is supporting Israel. The bombs that were falling on the bunker of Nasrallah were American bombs. The bombs that fall on Gaza are American bombs. The children who were killed, 17,000 of them in Gaza, were killed by American ammunition. And America, United States, cannot say that it is against killing children because it is a partner.
Gideon Levy, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Award-winning Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, also on their editorial board. We'll link to your latest pieces, including Israel's barbaric glee over Nasrallah's assassination is a new low for Israeli society. This is Democracy Now! We're going to turn to Washington, D.C. right now for more on all of this, to look at how Iran could respond to the Israeli strike Friday in Lebanon that killed the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. We go to Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's just written a piece for Zateo, headlined, "Nasrallah Assassinated, What Happens Next?" Trita, thanks for joining us again. What happens next? And can you respond to the assassination of the longtime Hezbollah leader since, 1992, Hassan Nasrallah?
So a lot of eyes are, of course, on Iran and trying to figure out what Iran is going to do next. But we have to recognize that Israel has quite successfully cornered Iran. Iran played the long game, tried to avoid a direct confrontation with Israel, absorbed a lot of hits. But in the process of playing the long game, its options have become fewer, weaker, and more dangerous. At this point, if Iran does almost anything, it will risk triggering the larger regional war that Netanyahu wants and that the Iranians have tried to avoid. As a result, I think our eyes should actually be on what Israel does next, whether it will go through with an invasion. We're already seeing reports now that some commando raids have been conducted inside of Lebanon by the Israelis, probably in preparation for a land invasion, as well as what Israel plans to do with the Houthis. If it reaches a point in which the Iranians conclude that Israel's strategy is to take out some of these entities before going to Iran itself, that may trigger the Iranians to act now in the hope of actually having better options now rather than waiting. But other than that, the Iranians seem to be of the mindset that they do not want to get in a direct engagement because of their own internal problems. Iran is faced with a significant anger from the population over the abuse and repression of the Iranian regime, particularly in the protest of 2 years ago. It does not believe that he actually can afford a war of this kind. Instead, its priorities are to try to see if he can get a deal with the United States on the nuclear issue, reduce tensions, lift some of the sanctions, improve the economy in order to reduce the distance between the society and the government. The last thing they want in that context is a war with Israel that will most likely increase that distance and the anger of the population.
In addition to the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah on Friday, Israel killed the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the deputy commander Abbas Nilfurushan, who was killed in that Nasrallah strike, a seminal or key figure in the Iran-Iraq war. Can you talk about his significance and then the role of the new Iranian president seen as a reformist?
So Iran has taken quite a lot of hits. Nilfurushan is just the latest commander that has been killed by the Israelis, not just since October 7th, but over the course of several years in Syria and in Lebanon itself. And this is part of their long game in terms of not necessarily reacting to each and every one of these, because they know that Israel is in a stronger position and Israel has an interest of having a confrontation sooner rather than later. But again, that strategy, that long-term strategy, only works if there's also a short game. And Iran's short game seems to be losing right now, given how Israel has managed to crack the communication system of Hezbollah, take out the top echelon of its commanders, and put Hezbollah in a very, very weak position.
So the U.S. struck Hodeidah in Yemen, and the Houthis. Now the question is how they will respond. Can you talk about Iran's relationship with the Houthis, with Hamas, and with Hezbollah?
I think one of the things that has not been acknowledged, at least not in the Western narrative about October 7th, is that it clearly came at a very bad time for the Iranians and for Hezbollah itself. I think actually there's been privately quite a lot of irritation in Tehran with Hamas, because it obviously did not coordinate any of that with Iranians. The Iranians, Hezbollah, were not even aware of the plans that Hamas had for that attack. And the reason, again, is because it forced a confrontation with Israel at a much earlier stage than what the Iranians and Hezbollah were ready for. Lebanon's economy was in complete disaster. Iran had its own problems. They were not looking for a fight. Hamas's calculation was completely different. And it also shows you the distance that does exist between these different entities. Iran and Hezbollah are much, much closer to each other, whereas Hamas is a more recent addition to Iran's axis and a very problematic one in terms of their relationship. They've had several fallouts. Hamas originally was quite a strong enemy of Iran. Then you have the Houthis, who is a very different entity, does its own thing, is part of the axis essentially, but has made it very clear it is not taking any orders from Iran. It's been quite critical publicly of Iran, arguing that Iran has been far too risk averse and that Iran should have entered into this fight much, much sooner rather than watching from afar and not aiding Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis to the extent that they believe that Iran should have.
I want to finally ask about the same question I put to Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv, Trita. You're Iranian-American. You've been writing extensively books on U.S.-Iranian-Israel policy. Among your books, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Your first book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. Do you feel that the Israeli prime minister is attempting to pull Iran into a war with the United States as the number one sponsor, the United States, of the military in Israel?
I don't think there is any doubt that that is Netanyahu's game plan. And the reason why he has been successful in the last couple of weeks is not because of any particular action by the Israelis, although, of course, they've scored some major successes. It's because of the posture of the Biden administration. Biden has chosen to be so deferential, more deferential than any other American president has been, to Netanyahu. And as a result, despite all of the talk of wanting to avoid a larger regional war, which clearly is in the U.S. interest to avoid, Biden has adopted a posture in which he essentially says that that's what he wants to avoid, but then he provides the Israelis with the weapons, the political protection, the diplomatic support, and the arms and money to be able to pursue exactly the escalation that Biden says that he does not want. That's the big difference that has happened here now, that the United States has now, under Biden, chosen to completely be in support of whatever Netanyahu wants to do. And Netanyahu's plan for quite some time has been to reverse the balance in the Middle East, to make sure that Israel is once again enjoying a much stronger and favorable position in the region by cutting down many of the different challengers to Israel that exist in the region. Reversing that balance is not something that Israel can do on its own. It can only do so by bringing in the United States into the war, whether it is directly or in the manner that Biden has been supporting everything that Israel is doing.
I mean, you have U.S. troops, you have the warships in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the Gulf, you have U.S. soldiers in Jordan, around 50,000 overall U.S. soldiers in the area. If this is intensified, how do you see this playing out in the U.S. election? Do you actually think, I mean, after Netanyahu addressed the U.S. Congress and got more applause than any president in U.S. history, I asked, what, more than 50 standing ovations, he went down to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump. This will serve Trump in this election.
Whether one thinks that Trump is going to be different or not from what Biden has done or what Harris may do, reality is, I think, that if you have this explosion taking place in the region, with the U.S. itself getting dragged into the war before the elections, it will serve Trump. The Biden administration have gone out and said that they've been working 24 hours without any rest to try to secure a ceasefire for more than 10 months now, and they have absolutely nothing to show for it except for constantly giving Israel more weapons and arms. And if that may not push away some of the more loyal supporters of the centrist elements of the Democratic Party, I think it does significantly risk losing a lot of the people who have been on the fence, who have given Biden the benefit of the doubt, certainly were willing to give Kamala Harris the benefit of the doubt. But if this disaster happens, I think that voting bloc, which I'm not talking about the Arab Americans or the Gen Z or the Muslim Americans, but that other voting bloc that is more on the fence on this, they may also be lost as a result of this.
Trita Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece in Zatteo, Nasrallah Assassinated, What Happens Next, author of a number of books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Next up, Hurricane Helene tears through the southeastern United States. As scientists say, climate change rapidly intensifies hurricanes. We'll speak with climate activist and scientist Peter Kalmus in North Carolina, one of the states hit hardest by the storm. Stay with us.
And the rich keep getting richer, and as wrong as they were right. Armies of the night.
never white.
Third World War by Kris Kristofferson. The politically conscious singer and actor died Saturday at the age of 88. He once said, quote, "I was in Nicaragua with Sandinistas. I've argued for Leonard Peltier, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the United Farm Workers. I've been a radical for a long time. I guess it's too bad. I'd be more marketable as a right-wing redneck. But I got this. I got into this to tell the truth," Kris Kristofferson said. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at Hurricane Helene as the Category 4 storm tore through the southeastern United States, leaving nearly 100 people dead in a trail of devastation. The storm triggered catastrophic flooding, tornado damage, downed trees, submerged entire neighborhoods in water across Florida, Georgia, Virginia, Tennessee, and North and South Carolina. At least 30 deaths were reported in a single county in North Carolina, Buncombe County, where the city of Asheville has been cut off after the Wananoa River crested 6 feet above previous records, flooding entire neighborhoods. Officials say the death toll is likely to rise as many more are still missing. Hundreds of roads remain blocked by mudslides and standing water, hindering rescue efforts and the delivery of vital aid and supplies. Meanwhile, more than 2 million customers remain without power as of Monday, while there's limited phone and communications access. In North Carolina, city officials say Asheville residents may not have access to clean water for weeks after Helene severely damaged its water treatment plant and piping system. Many state residents criticized officials for failing to share accurate information about the severity of the storm ahead of it making landfall. Hurricane Helene made landfall Friday in Florida's Big Bend, fueled by abnormally warm water in the Gulf of Mexico. On Saturday, Greenpeace posted on social media that, quote, "Hurricane Helene must be a wake-up call for climate justice." For more, we go to Raleigh, North Carolina, where we're joined by Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. He's speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. Peter, can you talk about the link between what has taken place in the southeastern United States and the climate catastrophe, climate change?
Yeah, so the planet's overheating. It's irreversible. It's caused by the fossil fuel industry. And the reason I say industry specifically and not fossil fuels is because this industry has been systematically lying and blocking action for almost 50 years, for decades and decades. And they've said publicly, testifying in front of Congress, that they plan to continue systematically blocking action. And this will get worse as the planet continues to get hotter. It's getting hotter every day. Every day we continue burning fossil fuels and allowing this industry to continue spreading disinformation and blocking action, the planet gets hotter. Hotter ocean fuels these storms, causes them to intensify more rapidly, causes them to get much more powerful, and a hotter atmosphere, because we're living on an currently overheating planet, hotter atmosphere holds more water. So we get these intense, intense rainfalls, which cause the sorts of flooding that's happening right now. It's still high waters in the western part of my state. I think that this is the most evil thing that it's possible to imagine, that fossil fuel executives and lobbyists will continue to lie so that they can line their bank accounts more at the irreversible expense of our planet and the future of humanity.
I saw you at Climate Week this past week here in New York City. Among the actions that took place was people attempting to shut down Citibank for funding, continuing to fund fossil fuel projects. The day that I was covering it, 31 people were arrested. Can you talk about the significance of these actions? I mean, you're a scientist. You, too, have been arrested protesting issues around climate change and entities that are involved in fueling climate change. What effect does activism have on the scientists? You're both.
Well, Yeah, I feel desperate as a climate scientist. I've been sounding the alarm since 2006. Other scientists have been sounding it for far longer. Dr. James Hansen in the 80s, even back before that. And we've been completely ignored. You get politicians, even like President Biden, even Democrats saying things that like, we listen to the scientists. And then, you know, the last presidential debate, we had Trump saying this is a hoax and giving word salad with China. And then Vice President Harris saying climate change is real, but we're going to expand fracking, right? And that's the cause of climate change. So we're living in this strange dystopia where scientists are being completely ignored. So I personally don't know what else to do. I've tried a lot of different kinds of activism. Civil disobedience has by far been the most effective in building the movement, inspiring other activists, getting this urgency. So we need the public to have two things before, I think, before we're going to be able to act, before we're going to hold these politicians to account. We need urgency and we need cause. And the public, in my opinion, doesn't know those two things. Like, they don't have the sense that this is existentially urgent, that this is irreversible. However hot the planet gets, that's how hot it's going to stay for the rest of our lives, for our children's lives, grandchildren, many, many generations, and they don't know cause. There's a lot of confusion. This is caused by the fossil fuel industry. So if we want to stop this, preserve what we can, we need to know that that's the cause, that they're blocking action, and we have to target that. Financing from the banks is a huge part of this. They're still expanding new fossil fuel projects like the Mountain Valley Pipeline in my state and in Virginia, which is creating natural gas for export that we don't even need in America, just so these fat cats like Joe Manchin can get more rich. People don't understand this, and they need to know. Urgency, this is irreversible. These storms, heat waves, floods, crop failures, migrants, all of this destabilization is going to get worse. It seems like we're, you know, just as humans, more interested in blowing each other up than being grateful and preserving this absolute jewel of a planet that has gives us all of this life, gives us literally everything. And it seems like we're not able to get our act together. And, you know, we have everything we need to stop this problem. We have solar panels, we have battery storage, we have wind. If there was will, if the media let people know, if the presidents and world leaders let people know urgency and cause, I think we would solve this so incredibly fast. But there's just confusion out there. The Republican Party is still deeply in denial. The Democratic Party is still deeply in denial. And it's just a human tragedy unfolding in real time. And I'm just so disappointed at everyone right now. But most people.
Dr. Khan, let's talk specifically about the media. It's the way people come to understand the world outside of their own conversations and their reading. Can you talk about how the media addresses climate change?
Yeah, so I was reading some articles about the flooding in Western North Carolina in the New York Times. The articles did not even mention climate change, not a single mention. This is what's driving it. And then there's the larger context of irreversible global overheating, which I've already mentioned. It's caused by the fossil fuel industry. They've been lying and blocking action systematically for decades, and this impact will get worse. We'll see even worse storms in the future. It's all like the gradation of climate impacts, everything we've been seeing around the world happening more frequently, more intensely, until, you know, global systems of infrastructure, food, water start to break down in ways that are hard to imagine for us right now. This all gets worse as things get hotter and hotter, driven by the fossil fuel industry, which has been lying. I think that's critical. Obviously, probably shouldn't say it in such an emotional way as what I've just said, because they're trying to be objective reporters. I'm speaking as a human right now, as a parent. Reporters need to start giving this whole context. This is part of the whole story.
We have 5 seconds, Peter.
Yeah. Anyway, do better, media, please.
Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. Happy birthday to Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.